In the past weeks, you may have heard the name Gabby Petito. She's the 22-year-old New York native whose disappearance during a cross-country trip with her boyfriend seized the attention of both social and traditional media. Now, tragically, Petito was found murdered in Wyoming, and her boyfriend, after reportedly returning back to his home in Florida, is now missing. Gabby's case has shined a light on dating and relationship violence among young people. According to the CDC, nearly one in every 11 high school girls and one in 14 high school boys have experienced physical dating violence in the last year. With And Another Thing from New England Public Media, I'm Maya Schwader.
And I'm Derek Kennedy. In a seven-day period, Gabby Petito had been mentioned 398 times on Fox News, 346 times on CNN, and no less than 100 times on MSNBC. That's according to data from the Washington Post. Coverage of the pharmacy tech has opened the conversations about how the disappearance of white women are handled in the news compared to cases of missing people of color. Zach Somers is a criminologist whose research includes criminal law, race, and the news media. He is also the author of The Missing White Woman Syndrome, an empirical analysis of race and gender disparities in online news coverage of missing persons. Based on data from the FBI and news outlets, his study uncovered disparities.
The KWT missing white woman syndrome, or the idea that certain types of missing persons garner more coverage than others. And the characteristics here that are consistent with that are that Gabby was a young white woman. She was of sufficient means to be able to travel across the country for multiple months on a road trip. And she fits at least some traditional definitions of beauty. This was a person who had a significant social media presence. She had thousands of followers. She was documenting this road trip pretty substantially on social media. But also, I think at the end of the day, it's fair to wonder if the case were the exact same, but the couple instead had been a Native American couple in their 60s, would this case have gotten the amount of news coverage that it received? I think that's a fair question to ask.
And you, as the author of Missing White Woman Syndrome, the piece that you authored a few years back, actually in 2016, began a movement because it did bring attention to the fact that there are disparities in coverage from people of color and Caucasians.
It's kind of you to say. It was the motivation behind the piece was to add to a discussion that I certainly didn't start, but tried to add a megaphone to. So there were plenty of people talking about missing white woman syndrome at that point in time, and now we're seeing an increased number of people talking about it. So the paper was designed to explore what did the data actually show. Do we have empirical support for this phenomenon? And the short answer was yes. The study seemed to corroborate exactly what we would expect.
The disparities that you found were based off of research you did across major news networks. Can you tell us what you found?
So I looked at four major internet news websites, CNN, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Chicago Tribune, and the Minneapolis Star Tribune. I wanted a mix of national and regional news sources. And what I did was look at all of the stories that they produced in one calendar year about missing persons. And then I compared the data that I collected from those stories and the people who appeared in those stories to the overall rates of missing persons as tabulated by the FBI. And what I found were, in short, were two levels of disparities. First, in terms of which missing persons received any news coverage at all. And what I found there was that people of color, and specifically African Americans, were underrepresented compared to rates of missingness. And then at the second stage, I looked at, okay, not just who received any coverage at all, but the amount of coverage that people received. And what I found was that the disparities were even more pronounced there, that white girls and white women were dramatically overrepresented as far as the number of stories written about them. They make up about one third of our country's population and made up a similar proportion of missing persons who appeared in the news in my data set, but they accounted for almost half of the articles written in the data set.
What can be done to address missing white woman syndrome?
It's a good question. I think we can do a few things. I think the biggest thing is to do exactly what you and I are doing right now and what your listeners are doing, which is learning about this topic, having discussions about this phenomenon, increasing awareness. I think we can also do a couple of tangible things, both on the news production side and on the news consumption side. With respect to news production, ensuring that our newsrooms and that editorial rooms and news companies are diverse places, I think is a crucial step. Making sure that we have a diversity of perspectives, backgrounds, life experiences is going to increase the chances that we see a more representative sample of missing persons who appear in the news. From a news consumption side, we can be deliberate about the stories that we read and the stories that we click. So as a news consumer, I intentionally, if I see a social media post or a news story about a missing person of color or an LGBT person who's gone missing, someone from an underrepresented group, I click that story. I read it. I give them that my eyeballs so that those metrics get passed along to news corporations, which it might seem like a small thing, but it's a tangible difference that we can make because those metrics matter because news corporations, at the end of the day, many of them are for-profit industries.
And then what's the responsibility, and I ask this because you are also trained as a criminal lawyer, what's the responsibility for law enforcement to step up their search for these missing people as well?
Law enforcement plays a unique role here because the newsworthiness determinations are not being made exclusively by news media. Law enforcement feed cases to news media, whether they think it's going to be a useful case as far as gaining attention and driving viewership or readership for news media. Or sometimes they leverage news media as an investigative tool to increase the number of leads and break open a case that they've had trouble solving.
Here in New England, there are open cases that have been trying to be solved, and the families have reached out for help and have wanted the same type of attention that other families have received. They are families of color, even as recent as last year, a young mother from Connecticut went missing. What the Gabby Petito case has done is allowed other families and people of color, as you call it, underrepresented groups, to now have a voice. What can those families now do or capitalize on this moment to help their case?
It's a tough situation because a lot of these families have been doing everything that they can for years. They've been doing the same types of things that we've seen the Petito family do. The problem was just that no one was listening. It's one of the potential silver linings to what is otherwise an unspeakably awful situation here that in terms of Gabby Petito's murder, that the conversation in the aftermath of her disappearance has, like you said, has raised some awareness of this issue. And so I think what those families can do is just to keep doing what they've been doing, to leverage social media to the best of their capabilities, to keep attention on these cases that for some of them have been going on for years at this point. But hopefully moving forward, this conversation and the scope and tone of this conversation, which feels different this time around, will lead to tangible progress with respect to those families being able to get the news coverage that they deserve.
Zach Sommers, criminologist and author of Missing White Woman Syndrome. Thank you so much for joining us on And Another Thing.
Thank you for having me.
According to NPR, nearly 100,000 Black women and girls went missing last year. But let's be honest, how many of them did you hear about? So when the story of a young missing girl gets lost or ignored, who keeps that story alive? Erica Marie is someone who's dedicated herself to shining a light on those underreported cases. She's an activist and writer who founded the website OurBlackGirls.com. Her reasons for starting the site were simple and personal.
I kind of like, well, if these girls go missing, they can't be the only ones that go missing. These white girls can't be the only people that have gone missing. I just still wasn't seeing any cases that looked like me. And so when I started to do some research, there were so many that had not been covered at all. And they're just things that I've never heard of dating back to the 90s.
I understand the wanting to see coverage of people that look like you, because we all know that it's not just white girls that go missing. Has the coverage of the Gabby Petito case and her disappearance and subsequent murder allowed coverage of these open cases that you have been working on over the years?
I think the public is coming forward and saying more and getting more involved.
In the days after the Gabby Petito discovery, 3 Indigenous people went missing in a week. Out on the West Coast, here in our region in New England, there are open cases of Connecticut women, specifically one that is as of recent as last year, the case of Diana Reitz, the mother from Connecticut. And I believe you featured her on your website as well.
Yeah, I mean, I come across cases through the national government database, and that's what I recommend. People are like, well, what can I do? We all live in different areas where we can raise awareness for at least one case where we come from.
Erica, you mentioned earlier social media and the impact that has. Of course, that's one big difference between, you know, the 80s and 90s and nowadays, is that social media plays a big role and was a huge factor in the Gabby Petito case. Is that helping to also elevate the stories of missing women of color? Or do you find that it's still kind of ignored by the same standards?
Well, I do think that it's helping to elevate levels of awareness, but not probably where we would like it to be within, you know, the Black community or other marginalized communities. I mean, I wish there was more consistency and that we didn't have like waves of care about, you know, this cause. I just want to make sure that we ride this wave as long as possible and we just don't fall back into our old behaviors of like, well, let's just dismiss this because she comes from an underserved community.
You also feature Erica Hamilton, who is out of Stamford, Connecticut, and has been missing since 2015, March of 2015, another woman of color. And on your website, when you do her profile, you list the numbers to call the Stamford Police Department. You list the detective's name. You give the agency case numbers. Is this information helping putting it out to the public?
I think that's really important because people don't have full access to that information because they don't know where to go. And if it's all provided in one space, they know exactly who to contact and what to talk about.
Erica Marie is an activist and the founder of OurBlackGirls.com. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate you.
Thank you for having me.
Teen dating violence is common. Teens often think some behaviors like teasing and name calling are a normal part of a relationship, but these behaviors can become abusive and develop into serious forms of violence. This information is according to the CDC. The study also reveals that many teens do not report unhealthy behaviors because they are afraid to tell family and friends. So, what tools are offered to help the youth better prepare for healthy dating relationships? And another thing, found a local organization that is set up to help teach just that.
Safe Passage is a domestic violence prevention agency in Hampshire County. They are launching a new program this fall with East Hampton High School called the Say Something Youth Initiative. And 15-year-old Zoe Tauscher is a graduate of the program's summer leadership training. Zoe is a 10th grader at East Hampton High. She told us that the case of Gabby Petito actually caught her mother's attention first.
So I personally did not follow it, but my mother did, and she actually was telling me a little bit about it.
What was your impression of what had happened there?
It was very concerning and almost frightening hearing about it.
There were a lot of stories that we heard afterwards from Gabby's friends that her relationship with her boyfriend wasn't healthy. In this course that you took, what did you learn about recognizing signs that someone might be in a troubled relationship?
Well, we learned what could potentially be dangerous or harmful in a relationship. And we also learned how to assess a situation and see whether or not it was safe for us to step in.
Before taking this course, had you learned anything about domestic violence?
I knew basics, you know, what your mom might tell you, if someone doesn't treat you right, get out of the relationship. But I'd never really known in depth how to handle a situation such as that.
So given what you've learned now, if you met someone who might be being mistreated by their partner, what steps would you take?
So first would be assess the safety of the situation. If it's something that it's not okay, but it's not dangerous, and then if it's dangerous, and then to assess self-safety. Is it necessary for me to step in? Am I safe stepping in?
What advice would you have for someone who might be listening right now, who may want to help someone get out of a relationship that's bad?
There are many different ways to go about this. You could start with talking to that person directly, saying, hey, I just wanted to let you know from an outsider point of view, I don't think this is okay. And I think that we should talk about this a little further and see where they are with that situation and see how comfortable they are then to move on to resources to help them out.
Do you feel like you were taught at all about how to be in a healthy relationship?
Yes, I have. Seeing my mother and my father's relationship has taught me a lot, especially because I was in the foster system until I was 11, when I was then adopted at 12 years old. So the change between the relationships I saw in my past versus that I see now is huge and very eye-opening. And I do now understand what is and isn't a healthy relationship based on the examples that I am seeing every day.
We are speaking with Zoe, a 15-year-old from East Hampton High School, who is a graduate from the Safe Passage Program. And now, if we can, let's bring in one of the facilitators of the Safe Passage Program, a prevention coordinator, Amy Cronin DiCaprio. Amy, also, thank you for sitting in on this conversation. I first want to say that if these are the girls and the people that are in your Safe Passage Program, you are doing a lot of things right over there. What was the stimulation behind getting this program started?
So this program is it's a collaboration between Safe Passage, East Hampton High, and Community Action Youth Programs. Right now, we're only at East Hampton High for our programming. There's two elements of the Say Something Youth Initiative. One is an in-classroom curriculum that all 9th and 10th graders are going to get. That is a bystander intervention violence prevention curriculum. And then there's also elective programming that is leadership development. And those are paid opportunities for students who are interested in building their leadership skills and building community with people that want to shift the culture at East Hampton High to support and promote healthy relationships.
And we know that that's for students and for kids, but the program you've run, the Say Something program, was for adults for many years now. How did you feel that there was a need to reach out to the younger generation?
So many times when adults in the community have come through the Say Something program, many of them who are parents will say, gosh, I wish that my daughter could be here. I wish that my son could be hearing this. I wish there was something like this in my kids' high school or middle school. You know, I spent my whole life, you know, not having these skills around assertive communication, around effective boundary setting, you know, and to learn them as an adult is great and super important, you know, but how much more powerful would it be to sort of, as you're developing relationships as a young person, to be building those skills at the same time.
Young Zoe mentioned how her mom was in tune with the news and knew about the Gabby Petito story, and how her mom and her dad were examples of how to be in a healthy relationship. What does research show about how often relationship abuse is happening for teenagers and how much parents are aware of what's happening?
That is a great question. I think it's something like 1 in 3 teens are maybe experiencing some kind of relationship abuse is what I think the data says. And what is particularly troubling is that almost 80% of parents who've been surveyed don't believe that dating violence is an issue for their kids or for their kids' friends. They don't believe that relationship violence is taking place among young people. Very few teens, maybe a third of teens who have experienced relationship abuse, tell anyone about it. And when parents don't believe that dating violence is an issue, you can see why teens don't always feel like they can share with their parents, right? So that's one of the things that we're trying to address and bring awareness to.
Is there also a focus on the LGBTQ healthy relationship, as that is a fast growing community amongst teens as well?
Yes. So our program, we have a specific focus on helping LGBTQ teens be supported in the East Hampton High community. And our curriculum really helps people build healthy relationships sort of across that span the gamut of any kind of relationships. We talk about consent. Consent is something that people need to know how to give and take and ask for and rescind. And that's a life skill in any kind of relationship. It's not limited to just romantic and sexual relationships.
Tell us about your hotline. If someone needs some resources or needs to call someone to talk, how do they do that?
That's 413-586-5066. And you can also call toll free at 888-345-5282.
Thanks so much to Amy Cronin DiCaprio, the facilitator of the Safe Passage Program. And we also heard from Zoe Tauscher. She is a 15-year-old at East Hampton High School and a graduate of the Safe Passage Say Something program.
And another thing on NEPM is funded by you and Westminster School in Simsbury, a boarding and day high school with opportunities in academics, athletics, and the arts. Open house October 9th, westminster-school.org. You're listening to New England Public Media.
This is And Another Thing. I'm Dara Kennedy.
And I'm Maya Schwader. A quick glance at mass.gov shows a whole lot of hotlines out there for people trying to leave bad relationships, including at least 7 in Western Mass alone. But a new hotline based in the Pioneer Valley is trying to address relationship abuse from the other angle. Monica Moran is the manager of the Domestic Violence Prevention Service with the Pioneer Valley Planning Commission. She's also the developer of the new 10-to-10 hotline for potential domestic abusers. The line is just launched in April of this year, and Monica joins us now on And Another Thing. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
This helpline is designed for the basis for this 10-to-10 hotline?
The basis for the hotline, the hotline is a totally new way of responding to domestic violence. What we're trying to do here is, I think for a long time we have looked at the victim or the survivor to be the solution to domestic violence. And the person who uses abuse, we want to take them out of the situation and like put them in a box, and they're not part of the whole thing unless the criminal justice system, gets involved and then they get arrested and put in jail or on probation or whatever. This is saying like there's a huge gap in our field, and there are people who are at risk of becoming abusive, or people maybe who have used abuse but want to change, and we don't have anything for them right now. There are court order groups, and they're fantastic, but almost all the people who go to those court order groups are ordered. You can go there voluntarily, but not very many people do. And so if we have somebody like a teen or anybody of any age who's like, this is not working for me anymore, this is not, I don't want to do this, all we really can say before is, try to stop, and the police will call if it gets that bad. And this is saying, wait a minute, let's offer something different. Let's say, if you want to change, or if you're worried and you want to know if what you're doing is abusive, mm-hmm. if your partner's saying, I'm afraid of you, or you're too controlling, then now there's this helpline and you can call, and we have people who can help you look at things from a different perspective.
So tell us a little bit briefly about a typical call. What does the counselor offer?
So we don't call them counselors. We call them responders, because one thing is that we don't offer counseling, right? And so it isn't like if somebody were to call and they are saying, I'm worried about my partner, what's happening, and, I grew up and I grew up and this is all I knew, and I had a, traumatic childhood. What we're saying is we're not going to go like a counselor might, and which would be totally appropriate, and try to heal that trauma. What we're saying is, we have information from people who are always safe in their relationships, even if they're upset. Even if they think that their partner is trying to get them, to do something. There are people who have grown up witnessing domestic violence. There's people who have suffered severe trauma, who have endured extreme stress, and they're always safe in their relationship. And so do you want to talk about what they're doing and what they're thinking and what their behaviors and what their values are? Because it might help you to think through, and we can talk about that together. So that's the kind of framework that we're using if somebody calls.
Monica, what is the hotline number and what are the hours again?
So it's 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. That's what the name comes from. And the number is 877-898-3411.
Monica Moran is the developer of the 10-to-10 hotline for potential domestic abusers.
That's it for this edition of And Another Thing. I'm Maya Schwader.
And I'm Dara Kennedy. We hope you'll join us again.